Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another amazing edition of Nerdy Notions. I am your fabulous host, the one, the only, and the ever snarky Sasha Kaplan. And as always, I am joined by my new fantabulous co-host, the one, the only, the equally snarky, fantabulatastic co-host, Caitlin Moore.
Alrighty, guys. I'm glad to be back.
So today we are reviewing Shang-Chi.
Yes, an actual good Marvel movie in this era. What a novel concept.
It is kind of impressive when you think about the fact that we had to deal with Black Widow to get here, which was ultimately not a terrible movie, but a very flawed one.
Black Widow was average, and I think we went over that in that episode, but this movie is actually good and worth watching. It's not a perfect movie, but it is good, and as we get into it, I will argue it as some of the best fight choreography of any of the Marvel movies.
That's actually, I think... So let's start with the story, then we'll talk about the fight choreography. So at the heart of this, we have this character who we first meet as Sean.
Yeah.
But first, before we actually meet Sean, we meet a very interesting, very old character who has these mystical 10 rings. Who we find out is Sean's father, who is the real Mandarin, quote-unquote, though they explain why that name is stupid. He is this, warlord, conqueror, mercenary, person, human thing. And these 10 rings keep him alive, and eventually he goes to this, mystical forest and meets this gorgeous woman that is an airbender.
Essentially, yes.
And they fall in love, blah, blah, blah. They have two children who we know are Shang-Chi and Xi Shaling. And this is kind of the story. What is the story at the heart of it? What is it actually about?
The thing about this movie really is family. And I know that's this entire series is about found family and family shows, but this one really is. It's about a family who was broken after the mother had died, essentially. So because of the father's previous actions as basically a warlord for the last 10,000 years.
Sorry, wrong podcast.
Okay. After that, the mom is killed by a rival gang, and how this breaks apart his family. He teaches Sean how to be an assassin, sends him out on his first hit when he's 14. He runs away after that, abandoning his sister back home,
who totally doesn't hold a grudge.
Well, again, they're children, so what can you do? And how that family kind of plays with all these dynamics, and how they deal with the mom's death, and the fact that their dad is still a evil warlord trying to take over the world. Well, not really, but...
I think we should clarify, though, is that he actually takes a pause on the whole warlord thing when he meets their mother. And she really brings out, I guess the way they paint it is, his humanity. And then after she dies, all of that basically gets reset. And he puts the rings on again, and I think he says, this was a person I could grow old with, but if she's gone, there's no point in growing old. So then we're introduced to this character named Sean, who is a valet parking guy, and he has a best friend named Katie, who is played by Awkwafina. And he and Awkwafina are, they're the kind of people that are, really could do so much more given the opportunity, but for some reason they don't take the opportunity. It's very I think they explained that Katie has an honors degree from Berkeley, and that they're just kind of two characters that haven't quite grown up.
Mm-hmm.
We understand from Sean's perspective why he hasn't grown up, as we learn throughout this movie. We actually learn, first of all, that his name is not Sean, it's actually Shang. And we learn this is where we get into the first really good fight scene of the film, which is this bus scene where him and Katie get on a bus and the assassins have arrived to take this pendant that belonged to Shang's mother. And we find out later there's two pendants, and they open up this whole, they open up a whole slew of, it's basically a convenient GPS.
Yeah, essentially it's a roadmap to how to get to the village their mom is from.
Which is, like, technically in, like, a different realm kind of a thing.
Well, less questions to ask about that one, the better.
But I like questions.
I know you do.
All right. That's not why we're here. So the first thing is, after this amazing, there's a scene which I actually thought was just pure hilarity of the fact that this is exactly how it would work out in real life, right? There's this epic fight scene. And Kitty at first is like, this guy can't even fight. Like, what are you doing? And he starts doing all these cool moves to fight these guys. And Kitty's like, what the heck? And then the rest of the people on this bus, one dude just, like, takes out his phone. He's like, hey, dudes, it's me, your boy, whatever his name is. I took some karate when I was younger, so I feel really qualified to judge this fight right here. And I just went, yep, this is our society. No, the first reaction isn't like, oh, maybe somebody should call the police or federal agents because there's this weird bunch of scary assassin people.
To be fair, this is the MCU, so this just might be an average Tuesday commute for these people.
But this is San Francisco. The only other character, superheroic entity that lives or lived there is Scott Lang.
Yeah, I mean, they might be used to dealing with who knows how much Ant-Man antics they get up to.
That's a good point. So there's this, like, it's a really cool fight scene overall. This one of the assassins has this, like, knife arm, and the bus, like, splits in half, and Katie's driving, and Katie's, like, a pretty decent driver. Her role in this movie, although, is really, like, not that important, but she's there to be, like, to remind Xiang of who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And she's there to drive.
She is there to drive, and at the end of the movie, she also ends up helping to defeat the bad guy.
This is true. I think her character, though, like, we know why Xiang is sort of clinging to this, like, simplicity, right? Of, like, not really doing what he could be doing to full potential, blah, 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 because he knows what his full potential is, essentially. But with Katie, she's, like, afraid of failure, essentially, and afraid that, like, she won't succeed in whatever she puts, you know, her mind to. And ultimately, the advice she gets from the people, from the warriors in this village, is really great. I don't know what will become of Katie in the future. I don't think she's a comic book based character. I think she was original to the MCU. But, you know, so let's talk about sort of how the story unfolds, because we have the main story, right, which is this conflict between Xiang and Xu Xiaoling and their father, who is, like, not the Mandarin, right? And they go to, why are they going to this village? What is the significance of this village?
So the significance of this village is that at the village, there is a door that basically leads to a realm infested by soul-eating demons who wants to break out and eat the souls of everyone. And in order to lure people into actually opening the door, they tempt people with their greatest desires. Which, in this case, would be for the father, him wanting his wife back. So he thinks that the village is keeping her locked behind this door, when in reality it's a bunch of soul-eating demons.
So he's essentially, like, really on a one-track mind and refuses to hear anything to the contrary of his own beliefs until it's almost too late. So then, instead of, like, this whole thing being about revenge and getting back to this village, it ends up, like, a good shot, like, what, like, two-thirds of the way through the movie, it becomes about this soul-eating demon thing, and how there's, like, this dragon and Great Protector, which I will say the design for the dragon is really cool, but my first question ultimately was, like, is this necessary?
This movie starts as a very grounded, very down-to-earth conflict with very good fight choreography, and then it becomes, like every MCU movie so far in this era, a CGI monster fest at the end of it. And don't get me wrong, it's a good CGI Monster Fest, but we don't need another CGI Monster Fest.
Oh, we really needed a cool dragon, though. We really didn't, but I really...
We did not.
But the design for the dragon, though, is really cool.
No, the dragon is cool. I love the dragon. The dragon can show up again and be happy. But, like, we didn't need this Monster Fest when we have such a brilliant setup for such a good movie. And then it goes in a weird CGI Monster Fest direction.
I guess you sort of have to do something that is kind of like on a large enough scale that garners the attention of, say, the Sorcerer Supreme.
I mean, you don't, because they kind of give that away. The Ten Rings themselves are what gain the attention of the Sorcerer Supreme.
Oh, that's true.
Because they're a beacon to something. What are they a beacon to? Who knows? We don't know yet. Maybe it'll get revealed in 18 movies later, or maybe they'll forget about it entirely.
Doesn't Carol have a cameo at the end of this?
She does.
Along with Wong and Mark Ruffalo's Bruce Banner.
Yep.
And so maybe part of that will be revealed in the Marvels.
Hopefully, but...
But we'll see. On that note, let's talk about Wong a little bit, because he does appear... This is the after credit scene is sort of his second appearance. He has an appearance earlier when they go to Macaw to look for Shang's sister.
Yeah.
What is going on with the Sorcerer Supreme when they go to Macaw?
He's fighting the Abomination for some reason, which gets into the series that ties into this movie the most, unfortunately so far, and that is She-Hulk.
It's okay. We have some time. We don't have to go there yet. Look, it'll be okay. I promise.
So there's like no context to this, but essentially he's fighting the Abomination in this scene because of reasons.
And there's a funny moment where there's a guy whose name is like Zhang Zhang or something.
Yes.
Which I started laughing so hard because it reminded me of Zhang Zhang, who is a firebender from Avatar The Last Airbender. That's not important. But basically, Zhang Zhang is like there. He introduces them to this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this fight between Wong and Abomination. And Zhang Zhang's like, always bet on Asian. And then Shang gets tossed in the ring, where we have our obligatory shirtless scene, because yeah. I guess every new character that is introduced in an MCU movie, male character, I should specify, has to have one scene where they are shirtless for the female gaze.
Apparently. So whatever that happened. So he ends up in this fight ring because he gets promised that they'll help him find his sister if he fights the combatant. And surprise, the person he's fighting is his sister.
Who is gorgeous. The actress playing his sister is, first of all, incredibly beautiful. Her name is, I'm going to butcher this and I apologize profusely, Mengjie Zhang. I apologize. She is amazing. And the way that she moves when she fights is incredibly just, it's amazing to watch. Like her training, forget this movie, forget everything. I could just watch her training montages for hours. Like the way that she moves is just so graceful and so, like, it's just gorgeous. Okay, I'm done gushing now.
No, like... In the story, actually, part of it is that she's all self-taught because her dad, who trained her brother to be this elite assassin, refused to train her. Because
girls can't be assassins, even though her mom kicked her dad's butt. Details. Mm-hmm. Look, Wenwu, is not exactly as smart as he thinks he is. Played by Tony Leung Chui Wei. Again, I apologize for butchering all of these names. But they have we can't call him the Mandarin. We have to call him Wenwu. Because Shang and his sister both get captured along with Katie and they get brought to the compound. And they are, greeted by, daddy's there and he's like, I knew my assassins weren't going to get you, but we're all going to go home now because we're going to be a family again. I'm like, okay. So he brings them back home. And they have this moment where Katie is asked what her Chinese name is. And she explains what it is. And he never refers to her as Katie. He uses her Chinese name as a way to honor tradition and culture. And at that point, you're like, okay, maybe this guy's not so bad. He's, you know, made some questionable choices, but could be worse. There are worse fathers in comics.
And there are a lot worse fathers in comics.
So, you know, let's give him the benefit of a doubt. And then he starts talking about the events of Iron Man 3, where, you know, for those that don't remember, they introduced this character called the Mandarin, who was played by Ben Kingsley, who turned out to not be the Mandarin. It was actually a hired actor named Trevor Slattery.
Which was actually a funny part in that movie. Not that anybody remembers Iron Man 3, because that ties into this movie, too, for reasons.
Just a little bit, because, well, there is also, like, it's either an after credit scene or it was one of those shorts where Trevor is in prison and somebody, like, knocks him out and kidnaps him or something. So you kind of have to build that bridge. And then Dad's like, so your mother called to me. And this is where the story really shows us where it's going, right? And they're like, oh, we're not doing this with you. And then they kind of go against the dad, and then they get recaptured, because even though they were already captured, and taken to the catacombs, the caves of, actually they look kind of cozy.
Yeah, and then that's where they're keeping Trevor this entire time, who basically they kept on as a stage performer because he was just apparently that entertaining.
I mean, he's kind of he's dumb in like an endearing sort of way, especially the part where they're on their way to the village, and he makes a point of explaining how he became an actor. Do you remember the scene?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I saw the Planet of the Apes. And he's like, Mom, how did they get those monkeys to do that? And the mom's like, no, they were acting. He goes, oh, so the monkeys were acting that they were on a horse. And it's like, is he serious? Does he still think the monkeys were just trained to pretend to ride horses? Like, I don't understand how any of this works, but okay. And we meet this cute little pillow thingy with wings.
Yeah. So this is the thing that actually guides them to the village. So this thing gets locked into the catacombs with Trevor and their friends. And so he's the only one that understands what this thing is saying. And this creature is the only one that can take them.
What was the creature's name?
Oh, God.
Marvin?
It was Melvin, Marvin, or
Reese.
Or something
like that.
Anyway, the creature's the only one that has the directions to get them to the village, and they have to beat their dad there so that their dad doesn't crack open the demon door.
And this is where we're introduced to some of the villagers, including their aunt, Ying Nan, who is played by the brilliant Oscar-winning Michelle Yeoh. And she, like, knows everything about them.
Somehow.
I have my notes pulled up here, and I think it's at the bottom here somewhere. It says, how does Auntie know literally anything about them?
I guess they had email back and forth, or they sent letters, or maybe the mom was allowed to visit her village on occasion.
They never really explained that, which is kind of unfortunate, but maybe there was something in her will that, like, said something. I don't get it, but okay. We forgot to talk about the fight scene at the end in Macaw.
Oh, right. It's another brilliant fight scene where they're basically fighting down the scaffolding of a building, and it is just, the lighting is perfect. It is gorgeous to look at. The choreography is great.
The way that it's shot is also really, really interesting, because you sometimes forget you're on a scaffolding. You just kind of, it kind of feels like this maze of, like, I don't know, poles and things like that. So then as soon as it pans back, you're like, oh, right, this is, like, you know, the 30th floor of a building. And if any of them fall, they're going to die.
Mm-hmm. Katie tries to defeat a bad guy using Hotel California.
Which is a callback to how she and Shang actually met, which I thought was really funny. Also because it was a really, not the worst rendition of Hotel California I've ever heard, but it was, yeah.
you hear the worst rendition at the end of the movie when they have the court, the karaoke scenes.
I've heard worse. I was at another karaoke. And, well, let's just say the music and lyrics went right. And the other person did not just go left. They went up, down, zigzag, wobbly, wobbly, timey, wimey, and out the door.
Basically, don't do karaoke, folks.
Karaoke is fun. It's just, I think, a little bit challenging for people who are, say, tone deaf.
That's why I don't do karaoke, folks.
It is still fun to watch and judge other people doing it. But that's not why. We do actually get a scene twice then of them doing karaoke. Once right before everything hits the fan, and then towards the end of the movie. So let's talk about, we haven't really talked about, like, Shang himself and sort of who he is as a person, because a lot of this movie is about him figuring that out. And, you know, we start the movie with him really thinking that he is his father's son. He did some shady things because his dad told him to, essentially, because his dad, you know, essentially brainwashed him. And then, so you sort of get the impression that, like, okay, so Shang is taking after the dad. His sister is kind of like, you know, the girl, so she's taking after the mom. But what's the reality here?
It's the opposite, like, completely. Look, so he definitely takes out more of the mother, eventually learning how she fought. And
he learned airbending.
He learned airbending, and that's how he ends up, like, helping to defeat his father and claiming the Ten Rings for himself, essentially, that he uses to fight the CGI monster. And then the sister, like, at the very end of the movie, we find out is leading the Ten Rings.
But it's interesting because the hints for it really shouldn't have come as a surprise, because the hints are all there. You know, Shang is more sensitive. He's, you know, very much like, he seems like very family oriented, the way he, like, bonds with Katie's grandma and mom. And meanwhile, Xiaoling is really, really cold, very distant, very, you know, there's a scene where, she talks to Katie about, like, how she became who she is. And Katie kind of pauses the story. And she's like, wait, you started an empire when you were 16? And her response was basically, well, my dad wouldn't let me play with his empire, so I made my own. And I just went, well, then.
Yeah. So the sister's the best character in this movie.
She really is. But let's talk a little bit more about this village. What do we think of the design of the village? What are some of the... What makes it unique from other places we've seen in the MCU?
Well, for one, I do like this village. I think the village is a good idea. I like the very intense Asian influences that this village
including
has.
In the mystical characters.
Yes, like everything, like, you can buy this. It's to me, it ring echoed a little bit of, like, Wakanda and what that meant for, like, how it pulled from a lot of African cultures to build it. And then you have basically, here's this village who's Tao Lao or something is the name of it, I think.
You keep talking. I'm going to look it up.
So yeah, and it's gorgeous. The setting is perfect. The demon door is scary. And all the creatures in this village are designed wonderfully. I can really believe that this is a lived in place. That being said, they have maybe 20 guys to guard this demon door at any occasion.
I mean, they are pretty strong fighters, and they have those cool dragon scale things that just sort of zap the demons to death.
Yeah, so like, why are the dragon scale, is the dragon red?
I don't.
So, like, they have all this dragon scale armor and equipment, and it all is, like, shiny and glows red. And I'm like, I guess the dragon is kind of. Sorry, pulled up a picture of the dragon.
We kind of had to double check because I also remember the dragon being, like, mostly this, like, pale grayish white color, especially when Shang first sees him in the water. But then we see this, like, beautiful, like, reddishness around him. So I guess, like, that's the scales. And the dragon just basically, like, chilling underwater. He's happy. And then, like, Shang-Chi tries to stop. His dad gets tossed in the water. And then he sees this dragon. And it's actually really cool how they reveal the dragon. Because he's like underwater and he's like dying, he's not dying, he's fine. And then you don't actually see the dragon's face at first. You sort of see the like the lean, thin body of this dragon as it's like moving around. So you just see this kind of like snake-like shape with like something on top, and you're like, oh, this is cool. So the dragon reveal is very cool. And you know, the CGI here is incredible. Like, this is a gorgeous dragon.
No, like I can buy the dragon actually being there. And I even like the design for the demon soul-eating monster thing, which is dragon-like to some extent, but then he has like these multiple tendril tails that whip around and grab people so he can suck out their souls. And he has a bunch of like bat-like minions that also like steal people's souls so that he can eat them.
There's also a bit where this is just like, I don't know why I keep going back to Avatar: The Last Airbender. But because, you know, Avatar: The Last Airbender builds so much from different types of Asian cultures that, like, yeah. So there's a scene where, like, Shang is running parallel to the dragon and he's got the Ten Rings. And I'm like, are you gonna do the dragon dance?
My God.
All right. That is enough of the I'll stop with my Avatar: The Last Airbender-ness.
No, that's not going to be all of it. Essentially, so like it all leads up to this phenomenal battle. The demon creature starts sucking the soul out of the dragon. Katie not like shoots an arrow at the demon's throat, letting it let go of the dragon so the dragon can be free. Shang-Chi then helps defeat the demon by exploding it with the Ten Rings, and then everybody kind of goes back home. Well, they don't go back home yet. After that, the battle is done, there's like maybe now like 10 people left in this village out of the 20 people.
There were more than 20 people, but they do suffer some losses, including the head of the archery guys,
Yes.
and girls. There's actually a really nice scene between the aunt and Shelling, because she's like watching these fighters, and the aunt comes over and she's like, you know, we women and men, like, we're equal in our fighting. Like, this, you're not, you're in your dad's house anymore. But yet she still practices by herself, but using the things that she knows. But now with the dragon scale, like, what do you call that weapon? Is it like a, it's not kind of like a, it's not a whip. But it is really, really cool how she maneuvers it and is able to do some really amazing, again, more amazing fight choreography in this
Yeah.
movie.
She also helps defeat the demon creature. Like, everyone contributes. I feel like, again, this village is rather smallish for the danger that supposedly exists behind the door. But that's just kind of me nitpicking a little bit.
Well, they did say there used to be others and they had like cities or something, and then they got decimated, or there's
Yeah,
still cities. So
but that would happen, like, what, thousands of years ago?
time is weird.
So, like, it took them 4,000, like, let's say it happened, like, the village existed for 4,000 years. Like, they state that in this movie. I'm like, okay, fine. This has been around for 4,000 years. Cool. And then they said that they had cities greater than anything on Earth. I'm like, awesome. And
Like,
then
we've
they're
kind of
like,
heard this line before, but that's
and
fine.
then
That's
they're like,
fine.
they were all destroyed by the demon creature thousands of years ago. And I'm like, awesome. You're telling me you guys never rebuilt for thousands of years? Okay.
It is what it is. You know, the as we said, the movie has flaws, but ultimately it is what I think we realize has been kind of missing from the MCU, is that, like, the epic adventures are cool and all, but like, I prefer the more, like, look, the third act Deus Ex Machina stuff is a little overkill, but ultimately it adds a flaw to the movie, but it doesn't, it's still ultimately about Shang and his journey and him realizing that he's not a monster. He's not just something that his dad made. He is a person who can have goals and dreams and really accomplish essentially anything. And he really needed that push.
There's more to this movie than just your kind of generic battle between good and evil that I feel like has kind of infested a lot of the more recent Marvel movies, where the conflict isn't personal.
It's not just that it's not personal, it's huge. it's large scale battles of epic proportions, and it's fighting for the sacredity of the universe or the safety of the multiverse, or you know, protecting the universe and the world. Like, even Wakanda Forever, which was excellent, and we'll get to that, is still very large scale, even though grief is such an important part of the movie. But that's why I think it balances the two.
Yes.
Right? And this movie does an okay job, even though at the end you have this, like, big thing that is just, like, a little overkill. But they do hint at the very least that something is very wrong with Dad. That, like, he's seeing their mother, and, oh, she's locked up, but she's dead. Like, this doesn't make sense. And we're not really given an explanation until later, when Michelle Yeoh's character explains that this creature is able to, like, it knows that the reason that it goes after Shang's dad is because it knows it needs the 10 rings, and it's the only thing that can free it. And so it's infecting him. How it's able to do that at such a great distance, even though it's, like, locked up, is a little unclear, but it's not a physical power, so maybe the dragon scale prison wall is only keeps the things in. It doesn't allow anything, like, mental.
I think they said that it sensed him through the 10 rings or something along those lines.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Like, I love these 10 rings. I wish we delved more into them. I hope the next movie we get about it really goes into what these rings are, where they came from, and now that they're a beacon to something. Like, I don't want that dropped. I need it.
Yep. There's also, like, this really awesome fight between Shang and his father using the rings. And his dad, I don't think he dies at the end, does he?
I think he gets his soul eaten.
I don't remember. We'll double check. But I think the fight is still amazing. Wait, I think he sacrifices himself at the end, doesn't he?
Yeah, so I know he dies. I just can't quite remember how. And I think it's because he does get his...
He saves Shang-Chi, bequeathing him the rings before the Dweller in Darkness kills him. Yeah, so he does die.
Because they make a lantern for him at the end of the movie.
And, you know, Xu Xiaoling takes over the 10 rings. So to go back to that earlier point, is that the epicness of this movie does, I think, take away a little bit from the original story, but it doesn't tarnish it. Whereas, like, with the Ant-Man movie, the last one, which, like, hey, massive spoilers for the rest of the MCU in case you guys didn't know what podcast this was. Even though the scale is technically in so many ways much smaller, it is very, very big, to the point where it's not really a story about Scott Lang anymore. It's a story about the quantum realm. Or even Kang the Conqueror. And so that then overpowers what the trilogy was about, which is essentially Scott trying to do the right thing and be the right person and be a dad and do all of these things, which is what made him so endearing and interesting as a character. So at the very least, there is plot driving the story, but it is Shang's actions that we're following that helps us drive the story, essentially.
I still remember watching this movie in theaters for the first time and feeling like that this was such a refreshing experience compared to every single Marvel movie I'd seen, like, beforehand, because you do have this personal conflict. And the fight choreography is, again, phenomenal for an MCU movie. Like, I don't think we've had anything this good since maybe Winter Soldier.
And it's interesting because at the end of the day, Shang doesn't have any powers. He didn't get a super soldier serum. He's not a god. He doesn't have a fancy suit. He's not I guess he is an assassin.
No, he's just a guy. And that is another thing that I love. And he's just a guy who does these things without any powers. He's just a really well-trained individual. And when he gets the 10 rings, it makes sense. The 10 rings are there to enhance what he's already able to do. It's not the source of his power.
Yeah.
If he doesn't have the 10 rings, he can just as easily be as successful of a fighter.
So it's actually interesting because according to IMDb, Simu Liu, who plays Shang-Chi, he already knew Taekwondo and gymnastics and Wing Chun. But for his role, You know, because Shang-Chi is the master of Kung Fu, he actually trained in Tai Chi, Wushu, Muay Thai, Pancak Silat, Krav Maga, Jiu-Jitsu, and like all of these other things, including boxing and street fighting, which is really, really cool. Which makes me hope that as cool as the Ten Rings are and all of this jazz, that the next time we see Shang, it's a little bit more street level. Because one of the things I liked about Falcon and Winter Soldier, about Hawkeye, is that you feel a little bit of a scale, but the story is not like low stakes compared to like, you know, the destruction of the universe, but it's a grounded street level story. And Marvel's street level heroes are just as important and just as amazing with what they can accomplish in when it comes to like working with your community and being the hero. And that's why I think like why a lot of the Spider-Man movies really work well is that he's a kid when he's a kid, and he is your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Right? And so I kind of hope we see something. I need a little bit, just a little bit more street level stuff and a little bit less the universe is imploding kind of thing, which gives me hope for Captain America, the Brave New World now.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, they just kind of went through all of the dystopian novels and decided that that this is the one that works.
Okay, so I'll get Captain America Electric Boogaloo 2, or whatever we decide to call it.
No, it was Captain America New World Order. Now it's Brave New World. I think then the sequel is actually going to be Captain America 1984, or Captain America Animal Farm, or Captain America The Hunger Games.
Captain America Atlas Shrugged.
I can feel the ghost of Ayn Rand about to kill me right now.
No, we're in the dark timeline when Iron Fist shows up in the next Shang-Chi movie. That's all I'm saying.
What's wrong with Iron Fist?
What's right with Iron Fist?
Ooh. Okay, so next up on Nerdy Notions, the Shang-Chi versus Iron Fist. No, I'm kidding. I liked Danny Rand. I didn't like the show.
It's not
I liked
a good Ren. Show at all.
No one said it was a good show. I'm not saying it's
Join
a good
us
show.
Now for our review of
all I am saying is that Danny Rand is a really fun character in the comics.
Well, yes, that is true. 100%.
But you were not specific enough with your answer there.
Fine. The MCU show is bad.
It's not even MCU anymore.
It is now because Daredevil is in the MCU.
I mean, it is the same Daredevil, but it's not the same Daredevil. It's how this all fits in. We will find out when Daredevil comes out, if it ever comes out, because there's still a writer's strike going on. And we hope that the writers get what they absolutely desperately need and deserve. But because of the strike, a lot of shows, as you guys know, have halted production. A lot of other shows, either because they haven't been finished and the writers left to strike, as they rightfully should, or certain projects have been halted because where they need to film is where the strike is happening. Or in the case of Stranger Things, they actually said, I believe, that without the writers, they weren't going to shoot the film, which is a really nice way of saying they support the writer's strike. Anyway, this is not the writer's strike show. So if we were to grade this movie, what do we give it on, like, if this is the final exam and this is the project that we are being handed by Kevin Feige, actually not by Kevin Feige, by the director of this movie, whose name I will tell you guys in just a second, by Destin Daniel Cretton. So what grade do we give Destin and his amazing writing team of Dave Callahan himself and Andrew Lanham?
This is a 7 out of 10 movie for me. It's a movie I'll rewatch again, not immediately, but probably like 6 months down the line. It's a good time if I just want a nice martial arts movie with the backdrop of superheroes.
Which is one of the things that I think we really have to consider when grading these films is how rewatchable is it? Like, in 6 months, and if I'm scrolling through Disney Plus, will I want to watch this movie? The answer is probably yes. But I will be honest, some of the more recent films that have come out on Disney Plus, I have not gone back to rewatch them.
That is fair. I mean, this one, I think, will also holds a lot of importance in the MCU, or at least I hope so. We'll see where it goes. But the building blocks are here for something. Now, if we want to talk about what direction that is, MCU needs to get its act together and figure that one out. But overall, I had a good time watching it. I wasn't bored. I wasn't waiting for the movie to end. Nobody massively annoyed me.
And that's good, because that does happen for us when we watch movies.
That'll be like the entire cast of Inhumans in about...
I'm sorry, what? The what?
The Immortals or Eternals or whatever that movie's called.
You said Inhuman, so I was about to go off the whole,
they're
like...
annoying, too, in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., frankly.
Yeah, yeah. But no, you were about to, like, mention the Eternal show, and I was like, wait, Eternals who? And you were going to be like, you know, the Eternal show. And I would have gone like, nope, that's not a thing. Doesn't
you
exist.
You remember the show set in Hawaii?
I vaguely remember that Medusa's wig looked really bad. And that Crystal was in this. Oh, and they had a lockjaw. And that's about all I remember.
Anyway, if you review this hard enough, we will review that series.
Yeah, so if there's anything that we are forgetting to talk about, or anything that we've dropped that you're like, oh my god, Caitlin, Sasha, you need to get off your butts and actually, like, record the episode of Inhumans. Please don't ask us to review Inhumans. I'm not rewatching that. I didn't even finish watching it the first time.
No one did.
But we will suffer through it so other people don't have to tell you why it sucked as badly as it did. So, Caitlin, where can the people find you on the social medias?
That is a very good question. So I will be soon running the Nerdy Notions Twitter when I can get my work schedule together, so you can find me there.
And what's that? Where? What is it called? What does it? What's the hashtag? What's the at?
I think it's at Nerdy Notions.
I think it's at Nerdy Two Notions.
Is it Nerdy Two Notions?
It's something like that.
Yeah.
I will link in, because you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. For however long I'm on Twitter, at Geeky Kaplan. That is Kaplan with a K, after, of course, the greatest superhero in the Marvel Universe, Billy Kaplan. And for this show, you can find us on Spotify and as Nerdy Notions, or on txhthockey.com/nerdynotions. And if my if you're Power Rangers fans, be sure to also check out our sister podcast that I'm also on, which is our Voices from the Grid show, where we suffer through, I mean, review lovingly every single episode of Power Rangers that we have been able to get to so far.
Wish them luck, folks. They'll be done in the next 30 years.
We're starting turbo, guys. So we're slowly trekking there. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to tweet at me, and let me know what you thought, or DM me on Tumblr, as some have done, which is geekgirl101.tumblr.com. And catch us next week when we suffer. Well, Caitlin suffers, and I just, you know, sit down, watch it, and take notes, because I don't have the visceral hatred for this movie that she does.
Goddamn.
Which is the attempt at the attempt to review the Eternals movie. So join us next time.